Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. Think of this story as a story about a contested divorce. By a vote of 4-1, the Grossmont Union High School District Board on Thursday made its intent clear. It will oppose allowing Alpine families to leave the Grossmont District to join forces with a unified Alpine Union School District. Board members Robert Shield, Dick Hoy, Jim Kelly, and Jim Steeringer all voted against unification, while board member Priscilla Schreiber cast the only vote in favor of letting the parents go. Unification would allow the Alpine District to serve students from kindergarten through 12th grade. Adding high school students to the elementary and middle school district in Alpine would make it possible for the Alpine District to finally build the long-promised high school that Grossmont has failed to build. Grossmont voters twice passed bond measures, Prop H and Prop U, to fund building a new high school in Alpine, but the board spent much of the money on other projects, some not even in the bond. Even a scathing grand jury report failed to prod Grossmont board members into taking action. The grand jury admonished the board to either agree to build the high school by the end of last year or cooperate with unification efforts to let parents effectively divorce the Grossmont district. Instead, the board has done neither. Before the vote, two citizens came forth to speak in favor of unification. Michael Waterman noted that the annual report for the district claims enrollment triggers for building an Alpine high school have not been met. He told the board, "That is false." He added, "The threshold number for the 12th high school was reached 3 times. He also told the board that there have been several bids for construction. Among them, one in 2010, where major bids were asked for, but at no point has the school board moved to actually start building the 12th high school. Waterman said staff found expenditures on construction in 2012 alone of $700,000. That's important because if unification does go through, the district could have to turn over funds slated for the 12th high school to the Alpine District. Waterman also said that the board misrepresented these facts when it told the grand jury, "We have not issued any requests for bids as related for construction to the 12th high school." He also pointed out to the board that this is not a policy matter since the courts view bond issues akin to a contract. Therefore, he believes the Grossmont District is breaking its contract with taxpayers. Barbara Stevens added to Waterman's thunder by telling the board district staff altered the number set by the board, and she added this material fact should not be concealed from the public. Before the vote, School Superintendent Ralph Swenson gave his report. He raised a series of issues that both the California Department of Education and the County Office of Education will ask when it holds public hearings on unification in both the Grossmont and the Alpine districts, since parents have gotten enough signatures to qualify for the unification effort. Among them are the quality of the educational programs and whether the makeup of the new district might lead to racism on campus. Staff will also have to deal with questions regarding debt, bonds, and property, and equitable distribution of resources. When the vote finally came, the resolution to oppose unification was introduced by member Jim Kelly, who has long thwarted efforts to build the school. At that point, member Priscilla Schreiber, who represents Alpine, asked to address the board for more than the allotted time. She brought a 5-minute statement, and the board agreed to hear it. Mrs. Schreiber started by reminding the board that in 2011, the governing board approved the superintendent's recommendation for a 12th high school. The board also agreed to start the school project but failed to follow through on actions required to make it happen, ignoring requirements that were met. The project was submitted to the state's design review committee but unilaterally pulled by the superintendent in April of 2012. The board has stubbornly refused to build the school despite 2 bond measures approved by voters and the grand jury report. The board has also ignored the safety of students, including several deaths due to students being forced to drive long distances for after-school activities such as sports on roads that can be icy during winter weather. The board's actions appear to be motivated politically, some say, not by concern for students or even by fiscal responsibility. The board, after all, has ignored arguments from community leaders and its own Boundaries Commission chairman, who concluded that the district would actually save money by building the high school, since this would attract new enrollment from adjoining districts and boost the average daily attendance money to the district. Despite these facts, Mrs. Schreiber made clear that there is now no certainty that the Grossmont District will ever build Alpines High School. Thus, she supports parents' efforts towards unification. After her speech, she received resounding applause from the audience. The board majority then proceeded to ignore the will of Alpine voters and the well-being of Alpine students, casting its vote against allowing Alpine families to leave the Grossmont District. The board action assured that the people of Alpine will face a continuing battle to wrest control of their children's futures away from the Grossmont board.
From the state's youngest to the oldest, lawmakers are considering two different proposals to increase educational opportunities for California students. One bill, the Kindergarten Readiness Act, would make voluntary transitional kindergarten available to every four-year-old by offering free preschool to those who can't afford it. The other bill expands college financial aid to illegal immigrants. The California Dream Loan Program has the support of UC President Janet Napolitano.
The University of California is a huge engine of social mobility, and you hear story after story of students whose lives were changed and their families' lives were changed because they had the opportunity to go to the university.
Supporters of the bill, SB 1210, say the loans will help undocumented students close the financial aid gap of up to $6,000, which would eliminate a student from having to take multiple jobs or drop out of college. Napolitano says the bill is about opportunity and fairness.
We should work as hard as we can to ensure that they have every chance to succeed.
The state already has extended in-state tuition to undocumented immigrants and made them eligible to apply for Cal grants. This is Lori Abbott, California News Service.
In 2007, when the devastating wildfires ripped through San Diego County, John Hartman and his family were left without a home. But the fires took more than replaceable items. They also separated the family from their dog, Buddy. But a $10 microchip implanted in Buddy 2 years before the fires is now responsible for reuniting the family, nearly 7 years after he went missing. Hartman said someone found Buddy soon after the fires and took him to a vet, but the dog quickly escaped and the family thought they had lost Buddy for good. Since then, Hartman and his wife moved to Oklahoma, but on a recent trip to San Diego to visit their son, they got one very surprise call from the County Department of Animal Services. After 7 years, Buddy had been found. Someone who reported finding the black lab loose in Imperial Beach dropped off the dog at the County Gaines Street Animal Shelter on March 28th. Staff scanned the dog for a microchip and matched it up to Hartman. We've reunited animals from across the country and even the world with their owners, but 7 years is one of the longest time periods we were able to reunite a pet and its owner, said Dan D'Souza, Deputy Director of Animal Services. The story could have had a tragic ending when the dog was lost during the wildfires, but the happy ending of this dog being reunited with its owner after moving from out of state can't be beat.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso. And today, my very special guest is Daniel Sullivan, who is the president and the founder of Sullivan Solar Power. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
We're going to be talking today about a decision that the California Public Utilities Commission has just made to extend net metering protection for solar homeowners for 20 years. Daniel, tell us how significant this decision will be.
Well, this is a monumental decision. There's been a lot of debate at the PUC and at the legislature about what we are going to do with customers, ratepayers who have gone solar and are net metering. Since 2001, the state legislature and the governor's office has sent clear positive policy signals to Californians to encourage them to go solar. And then over the past 3 years, the utilities have mounted an attack against net metered customers to try to get them to have their systems not as financially attractive as they were when they went solar. So the solar industry rallied to make sure that the collective voices of those who have gone solar were heard and to protect their investments for a 20-year period. Now, in order for somebody to truly understand what this means, they have to understand how net metering works and what that is.
Yeah, first, can you describe for people who don't know exactly what net metering means? Can you define that?
Absolutely. So a regular ratepayer uses electricity from the grid. They pull power whenever their appliances come on and they get billed for it. Now, when you put a solar power system on your roof, during the day, that energy that the system produces first goes into the home to fulfill the needs of the home, and the excess energy gets exported out to the grid and generates credits on your electric bill via your electric meter. At nighttime, obviously, solar power is not on, so you have to use the power from the grid. The power that you use from the grid runs against those credits, and they take the net of what you produced versus what you consume to come up with your electric bill, hence the term net metering. Mm-hmm. That's the foundation of what's built the solar power industry in the state of California so far.
So you can basically recoup a lot of your costs and eventually be paying zero utility bills.
Exactly. Great. Exactly.
Okay. And does it apply only to homeowners, by the way, or does it also include business owners?
Business owners, school districts, water districts. Collectively in the state of California, there are over 150,000 entities that have gone solar and invested in our renewable future in response to the policy signals from the state of California, such as net metering. And when they did so with a long-term investment horizon of 20 years or more.
What is the history that got us to this point?
Back in 2001, many Californians will remember we had our energy crisis with market manipulation by the energy
Enron.
Companies. Yeah. Our buddies at Enron and the like. And so in response to that, the state of California realized we need to diversify what our energy resources are. And they created the California Emerging Renewables Program, which provided the initial rebates to spur the growth of this market. And they strengthened the net metering laws to get more and more people to invest in solar power. So that's what really sparked the solar energy revolution in the state of California back in 2001. Since then, as I said earlier, we've installed thousands and thousands and thousands of systems, much to the dislike of the utility companies.
Yeah, they were fighting this thing tooth and nail, I understand. They were up there in Sacramento trying to kill net metering
exactly.
So that you and I would not be able to have zero utility bills, which, by the way, is already far less than Germany and some other places that have stronger net metering where you can actually earn a profit by selling your surplus power back to the grid.
Right. So it's true that the utilities were doing a bang-up job of trying to shut down net metering. So why this decision that came out is so important is the PUC said, okay, all these people who have gone solar are going to be protected with the rules that they are accustomed to for the next 20 years.
There you go.
What that means is for the next 20 years, they're going to get full retail credit for anything they provide to the grid, as opposed to some reduced value that the utilities would like to see in the coming years.
Does this signal, do you think, a bit of a loss of stranglehold of power by the utilities up there? I have to say I was a little bit surprised it went through because the utilities seem to get their way most of the time on things like this.
Well, I think our state is moving in the right direction. The legislature and the governor's office are very much pro-renewables and pro-distributed generation. They want to encourage investments in renewable energy on the customer side of the meter. Mm-hmm. They understand that we cannot be entirely dependent on the utilities for our energy portfolio. And so they want to make sure there are policy signals to the market saying, we encourage you to go solar. And why this is very important to the listeners is that those who are considering going solar, now is the time to do so. Because if they do so in the next year, it's very likely that they will be grandfathered, which is what this decision is about, next 20 years. So for the next 20 years, they'll get full retail credit for anything they put on the grid.
Yeah, I understand there's a total cap of 600 megawatts for net metering. And once that's hit, enough people buy it,
Then we're on a whole new set of rules. And the amount of credit that you would get for what you produce to the grid is yet to be determined. So we know what we have now is full retail credit. As long as you go solar in the next year or so, you're going to be able to get that. The guys that wait and procrastinate and say, hey, I'm going to wait for the next best thing, go solar 2 years from now, they're not going to have the same benefits as somebody that does today.
Well, very good. I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
East County residents are familiar with Hammond Industries, a 50-year-old construction company in East County. A variety of large-scale development projects are proposed on Rough Acres Ranch on McCain Valley Road and Boulevard, gateway to McCain Valley, a federal recreation area, on properties controlled by Hammond Companies, other Hammond entities, and the Hammond family. These projects and proposals have not been popular with many of Hammond's neighbors. Hammond has already gained approval for several 500-foot-tall industrial wind turbines as part of the Thule Wind Project and has also been pushing to convert another 765 acres to industrial solar as part of Soiltech's controversial plans, which also include rock crushing and concrete making operations. The site also hosted the groundbreaking for Sunrise PowerLink, drawing protesters from across the county. Now Hammond is also seeking a major use permit to construct a conference retreat and wellness center and a campground on 713 acres at Rough Acre Ranch. The facility could house up to 2,600 people, or more than twice the current population of the entire town of Boulevard. The project would include a lodge, 22 bungalows, a bunkhouse, barn, various outbuildings, and an existing helipad built by SDG&E. A guest house and poultry coops would also be rebuilt. In addition, the project would add two campgrounds with 149 campsites, two clubhouses, two swimming pools, an equestrian center, a 200-person amphitheater, archery course, skeet shooting range, athletic field, and new ranch residences. The project would require road widening and new road construction as well. The Boulevard Planning Group will hold a hearing on the project on May 8th. The county is accepting public comments on the Rough Acre Ranch Conference Retreat, Wellness Center, and Campground proposals. Comments can be submitted up until 4 p.m. on May 12th. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
Closing arguments are expected to begin this week in the trial of Kasim Al-Himidi, who is accused of murdering his wife, Shema Alawadi, in El Cajon. But the trial raises many troubling questions. Police have admitted to doctoring a photograph to make it appear that Al-Himidi's van was parked near the family's home when the murder occurred. Confronted with the photo, he reportedly told police his vehicle may have been there, but he has steadfastly insisted he did not kill his wife. Police believe Shema Alawadi may have been bludgeoned to death in her home with a tire iron, but tire irons removed from her husband's car had no traces of blood. In fact, no forensic evidence at all has been presented to tie Al-Himidi to the crime. Police have suggested that Al-Himidi had motive to kill his wife because she had filed papers seeking a divorce. But he is not the only one with a motive. The couple's daughter, Fatima, was distraught over being pushed into an arranged marriage with a cousin in Iraq. She has testified that she was romantically involved with a Chaldean Christian man, a relationship of which her Muslim parents disapproved. And she has also admitted to sneaking the boyfriend into her bedroom. On the day of the murder, Fatima has provided conflicting statements as to whether she was in the shower or asleep. She told police she heard her mother squeal, but was not sufficiently alarmed to investigate. Shema was struck numerous times with a heavy object and died several days later in a hospital, never regaining consciousness. Fatima also told a friend she saw a, quote, white guy fleeing the murder scene. A note found near her mother's body and a similar note left at the home a week before read, go back to your country, you terrorist. Police arranged photo lineups of white guys over the next several weeks, but Fatima did not identify any of the individuals. She later called police and inexplicably claimed that she now believed her father was the killer. A friend of Fatima's testified that Fatima told her on several occasions that she hated her mother and wished she were dead. Asked about those statements on the witness stand, Fatima said she didn't remember. She reportedly had run away from home many times, staying overnight, often at her friend's home. A source has also informed East County Magazine that Fatima jumped from a moving car on one occasion to escape parental control. Fatima has said that her mother didn't like her father and was determined to divorce him. But Is that sufficient evidence to charge and convict a man of murder? A conviction requires that 12 jurors be persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused is guilty of a crime. It would appear that numerous doubts have been raised by the defense, while it's unclear what compelled prosecutors to hone in on Al-Hamidi. It remains to be seen whether Fatima's conflicted testimony, deceptive police tactics, lack of forensic evidence, and absence of any eyewitness account would lead a jury to acquit or convict Kasim Al-Hamidi. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
They're definitely adorable because they're small and they're cute and people want them, but people don't realize what they're getting into.
Judith Pierce is the adoptions director for the San Diego Companion Rabbit Society, an all-volunteer, nonprofit rabbit welfare organization. She urges families to do their homework and realize that a rabbit is as big a commitment as a dog.
Most people think that they might have a rabbit for 2 or 3 years and that makes them an easy starter pet, but that's not true. Rabbits are a long-term commitment. Their average lifespan is 8 to 12 years, and that's how long they're meant to be with you.
Unfortunately, many impulse buyers are unaware of this fact or of the responsibility required, and a few months down the road of rabbit ownership, they give up.
Especially about 3 months after Easter, the bunnies start pouring in. We're finding bunnies left in fields, bunnies hopping along the street, dumped in neighborhoods. If they're lucky, they're brought to the shelter or somebody calls an organization like ours.
Throughout San Diego County, over 500 rabbits are brought into county shelters or organizations like this one. The San Diego Companion Rabbit Society works with these shelters to help them properly care for their rabbits.
We provide supplies, we provide training for staff and volunteers, we support them by providing all of the spay and neuter surgeries for rabbits that come through the county system, so that makes them adoptable right away and they can find new homes faster.
With so many rabbits in shelters and rescue organizations, Judith urges potential bunny owners to start there rather than pet stores to find their new pet.
The good thing about adopting from a rescue or a shelter is that they are going to teach you how to care for this rabbit. Also, it's going to be already spayed or neutered and litter box trained. So you already have a rabbit that's ready to come into your home and to be an indoor family companion and live that expected 8 to 12 years. This is Scout, and this is Harper Lee. Rabbits are just funny, and they're friendly. They're acrobatics. They're very athletic. When they're happy, they shake their ears, and they waggle their tails. They like to play with toys. They actually will learn to play games. They will teach you games. They'll greet you at your front door when you come home at the end of the day. Very interactive.
If you are willing and able to provide a loving home to a rabbit for the next 10 years, just be sure you do your research and maybe avoid the Easter season.
Spend some time thinking about it. Do your homework. Go online and learn about rabbit care. You can visit the House Rabbit Society and get information about rabbits. And then visit your local shelter or come to a rescue in your area and meet different rabbits to find the one that's the perfect match for you.
Closing arguments are expected to begin this week in the trial of Kasim Al-Hamidi, who is accused of murdering his wife, Shema Alawadi, in El Cajon. But the trial raises many troubling questions. Police have admitted to doctoring a photograph to make it appear that Al-Hamidi's van was parked near the family's home when the murder occurred. Confronted with the photo, he reportedly told police his vehicle may have been there, but he has steadfastly insisted he did not kill his wife. Police believe Shema Alawadi may have been bludgeoned to death in her home with a tire iron, but tire irons removed from her husband's car had no traces of blood. In fact, no forensic evidence at all has been presented to tie Al-Hamidi to the crime. Police have suggested that Al-Hamidi had motive to kill his wife because she had filed papers seeking a divorce. But he is not the only one with a motive. The couple's daughter, Fatima, was distraught over being pushed into an arranged marriage with a cousin in Iraq. She has testified that she was romantically involved with a Chaldean Christian man, a relationship of which her Muslim parents disapproved. And she has also admitted to sneaking the boyfriend into her bedroom. On the day of the murder, Fatima has provided conflicting statements as to whether she was in the shower or asleep. She told police she heard her mother squeal, but was not sufficiently alarmed to investigate. Shema was struck numerous times with a heavy object and died several days later in a hospital, never regaining consciousness.
Fatima also told a friend she saw a, quote, white guy fleeing the murder scene. A note found near her mother's body and a similar note left at the home a week before read, "Go back to your country, you terrorist." Police arranged photo lineups of white guys over the next several weeks, but Fatima did not identify any of the individuals. She later called police and inexplicably claimed that she now believed her father was the killer. A friend of Fatima's testified that Fatima told her on several occasions that she hated her mother and wished she were dead. Asked about those statements on the witness stand, Fatima said she didn't remember. She reportedly had run away from home many times, staying overnight, often at her friend's home. A source has also informed East County Magazine that Fatima jumped from a moving car on one occasion to escape parental control. Fatima has said that her mother didn't like her father and was determined to divorce him. But is that sufficient evidence to charge and convict a man of murder? A conviction requires that 12 jurors be persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused is guilty of a crime. It would appear that numerous doubts have been raised by the defense, while it's unclear what compelled prosecutors to hone in on Al-Hamidi. It remains to be seen whether Fatima's conflicted testimony, deceptive police tactics, lack of forensic evidence, and absence of any eyewitness account would lead a jury to acquit or convict Kasim Al-Hamidi. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Last year on Christmas Eve, Salvatore Belvedere and his brother's fiancée, Ilona Flint, were found mortally wounded in a vehicle parked at Mission Valley Center. Ilona managed to call 911 despite having been shot in the head. She died at the scene, and Salvatore later succumbed to his wounds at a hospital. Both were 22 years old. Salvatore's older brother, Gianni, Ilona's fiancé, was missing at the time. 3 weeks later, his body was found in the trunk of a sedan at a Jack in the Box restaurant near March Air Force Base. He, too, had been shot in the head. This triple murder case has never been solved. Police have ruled all three deaths homicides. No motive for the killings has been disclosed, though a possible suspect was seen at the mall shooting site. A man nearly 6 feet tall, wearing tan pants, white tennis shoes, and a black hooded sweatshirt with white bands across the upper sleeves is sought by police. On Sunday, relatives of the slain family members held a fundraiser at Eastbound Bar and Grill in Lakeside, raising money in hopes to boosting the reward to $25,000 or $50,000. Friends brought donated items to auction off for the cause. Eastbound also agreed to donate a portion of the day's proceeds to benefit the family. Anyone interested in giving can get contact information online at a website titled Justice for Sal, Gianni, and Ilona at www.justiceforsd3.com. The website states that it is intended to get justice for three wonderful people who are loved by their family and friends, adding, "These three people deserve justice." The boy's mother, who suffers from a crippling illness, writes of her own painful ordeal. "We are good parents. We prayed, and we taught them good morals. There has never been any violence in our family. Why, Lord, are we being punished?" she asks. The family formerly owned Mario's, a popular Italian restaurant locally, before selling and moving to Utah, where Gianni met his fiancée, Ilona. Gianni, Ilona, and Salvatore were described as very close friends who were often seen together. The family's website claims that rumors of love triangles or drug deals do not have any merit and that the loss has been difficult for the families of the victims. The family statement adds, "But what is even scarier is the person is still out there, and these young adults could be your kids. If someone is cold-hearted enough to take three lives during a time that is supposed to be forgiving and being with your loved ones, what is to stop this from happening again? This murderer needs to be caught and brought to justice before anyone else loses another child." This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. And today, we're going to be talking about what to do over spring break.
Spring break.
All right. It's finally here.
Staycation.
Cool. Now, I've got, as you can hear, my staff with me here, Ariel, who does our Destination East County segment, and Leon and Ed. Ed's a parent, and Leon's an outdoorsy kind of guy. So we're going to be telling you about both things to do if you're a college student and you're in town over spring break, you're not going away. There's some great things to do right here in East County. And if you're a parent and you have little kids home for spring break, we've got some ideas for you, too. So, guys, what are some of the best outdoor adventures that you can find in East County? Leon, what's your favorite hike that you're aware of?
There's a lot of good hiking in San Diego County, East County, everywhere. Up in the mountains, Cuyamaca, Laguna, the Three Sisters Falls, the Cedar Falls.
Cedar Creek Falls is one of the most popular with a lot of the college kids out there. And what do they need to know if they want to go find this beautiful place that, at least when there's a lot of water there, is just a gorgeous, spectacular waterfall with a swimming hole underneath?
Well, they need to have a permit.
Right.
If you hike out there, you have to have a permit, which is a good thing because it is a place that could slip and fall. People are pulled out of there from time to time. So be careful and make sure you let them know that you're going down there.
U.S. Forest Service.
Yes. And as of last month, the 30th of last month, there was water at the bottom of the creek. Clear, so clear that you can see down into the lake, which is good because there's rocks and stuff down there. But it's a great, great place to hike and have a little swim on a hot summer day.
It's a great place. No alcohol. They've banned that. And they've also banned jumping or diving off the rocks because, as you noted, there have been some injuries. But if you follow the rules, it's probably one of the most gorgeous places.
Yes, on the website, Romantic Places to Go, it's rated one of the top 10 places that you can hike with someone who you want to be with.
Very good. Ed, what's your favorite outdoor destination in East County?
Lake Cuyamaca is probably my favorite place because you can go there and you can camp in their cabins and can paddle on the lake there, kayak, do all sorts of hiking around there, real easy hikes. You know, you could take your grandma there hiking and you could fish as well.
Beautiful place.
Yeah, it's kind of a small lake and it's low key. It's not too crowded out there. It's a real nice place to go with your family and have some fun.
Now, there's a lot of other things. For those that are feeling daring, there's some extreme sport opportunities. What are some of those?
Hang gliding that you can do over in sort of the Blossom Valley area. And then you can also, there's a glider port, and then there's like
Jeep Warner Springs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's like Jeep tours that you can do.
Yeah, I think Overland Adventures offers off-road Jeep tours down into the Anza-Borrego Desert and also wine tasting tours through the backcountry in our mountain areas. And there's also horseback riding, and in fact, for those of you over 21, there's even a vineyard tours of on horseback that you can take, wine tasting on horseback.
Yeah, and I'm sure you can find somewhere to go skydiving.
Yeah, all kinds of things, stargazing, you name it. Now, Ariel, you do the Destination East County segment for us. What are some of the biggest festivals that would be great, not only for the college kids, but the whole family? Can you tell us about a few of the ones coming up?
Sure, Miriam. The Spring Harp Fest is a good one for music enthusiasts. It's referring to the Blues Harmonica, and it's an annual festival. It's happening this weekend.
That's in La Mesa?
Right, it's at Harry Griffin Park. Mm-hmm. And Cajon Classic Cruises, the annual car show that they have in downtown El Cajon, revs up this Wednesday, the 23rd, and will be every Wednesday until October.
Now, there's some big events coming up in Lakeside, too. Tell us about that.
Well, Lakeside is celebrating all weekend. The 49th Annual Lakeside Western Days Parade is on Saturday.
And that's Saturday next week in the 26th.
That's right. And the events include the parade and with the theme Lakeside, where the West is still alive. Lots of activities that day because they have a Western Days along with the parade. Mm-hmm. There's a barbecue the night before on Friday night right at the Lakeside Rodeo Grounds by the Optimist Club. And then the rodeo is going on all weekend with performances Friday, Saturday, and Sundays that you can get tickets for.
There you go. And Ariel, I understand there's also a big music festival that a lot of people like to howl about. Tell us about that.
The Coyote Music Festival is going to be at Cuyamaca College on the campus grand lawn, and that's Saturday, April 26th. You know, this festival features 7 bands that are up-and-coming local talent.
Wow.
Free parking, free admission, you can't beat it.
This is not a bunch of coyotes making music together?
Well, there might be that too, you know, especially as the music festival gets going and people get warmed up.
There you go. Believe it or not, we do have nightlife in East County.
And that is not all outdoorsy. I do indoorsy as well.
That's right. For example, there's live comedy on certain Monday nights out at the Internet Space Bar Cafe in La Mesa,
yes.
Brouhaha. Yeah, the name alone would make you want to go, I think.
This Wednesday is the day for the last Wednesday of the month, free comedy night that's at the Regal in La Mesa.
Way to go.
And they have top comics. So this weekend is, this week coming up, that Wednesday is.
Ariel knows all of them.
I'll bet she does.
She knows all the freebies, too.
Yeah, there's an open mic night or something out at Downtown Cafe as well.
Downtown Cafe Sunday afternoon with Chet and the committee singing blues. He's always got a guest harmonica player or a blues guitar player or a new drummer or a new vocalist there.
Very
and then they have
cool.
open
that
mics
cool.
in the afternoon. Right in the middle of downtown Alcohol. The place is packed every Sunday
great
afternoon.
Great food.
And I think, Ed, you were telling me about a place out in Lakeside that's got a lot of live entertainment.
Yeah, Eastbound is well known. They do a lot for the local community also. And it's great food and great atmosphere.
And live entertainment.
Oh, yeah. They have bands and they do karaoke and all those kind of things.
Yeah, there's all kinds of them. Let's talk about some things for the younger children now. Ed, you're a parent. Where are some of the places you've found to go take your son to have some fun?
Yeah, lately I've been checking out the rec centers. They've got lots of fun activities. They're very affordable. If you're a resident in the community, it's very affordable. And even if you're from outside the community, it's only like $5 more to sign up for lots of programs that they offer. I just took my boy to Scooter Camp all last week in Sandy.
What is Scooter Camp?
I saw that.
Sounds
basically
fun.
They just ride scooters in the skate park and they learn how to
cool.
do tricks.
Skills, certain skills.
I loved these.
Yeah, when my kids were little, we did a lot of them at the La Mesa Rec Center. I know El Cajon has a lot. And it's not just sports stuff. There's art classes and music and dance and all kinds of different things. Science now. For children of all ages, the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College in El Cajon has a butterfly pavilion.
Yes, my grandchildren and I went for the opening, and it's really beautiful. Plus, it's just one of the most gorgeous places if you want to just go and look at the gardens, stop and read in one of the little back areas, and just quiet, gorgeous place.
Fantastic. Another really popular destination in East County during the winter and the early spring months like this is the Anzabrego Desert State Park. If it's not too hot, there's even a wildflower hotline you can call. There's a lot of activities right out of the visitor center, or you can go to the Anzabrego Desert Foundation to see even more activities, hikes, some ranger-led hikes, all kinds of things. And then there's the Hakumba Hiker and Walkers right here in East County that lead a lot of weekend hikes, too.
Lots to check out.
And we can't leave out Santee Lakes if you live in that part of the county. For outdoor activity for the whole family, there's fishing and hiking, there's boats and canoes, there's entertainment out there.
Camping.
There's great campground out there.
Pedal boats on the lake.
Swimming pool. And there's Lake 1, Lake 2, Lake 3. And all, as you go up, the lakes all have a different purpose. And you go way up, there's a couple of them that you can take and only walk your dog around. It's just like a doggy lake. And then they're all surrounded with trees and birds and ducks and white pelicans.
Yeah, there's a lot of other places. Lake Jennings, a lot of other lakes around, too. You can go on the county website, County Parks, and you can also get a list of all kinds of activities. Some of them or ranger-led activities at all of the different county parks as well.
And Mission Trails Regional Park.
Mission Trails Regional Park.
Yeah, they have rock climbing for your adventurous at heart, and a lot of, what are some of the kind of activities they have for the younger set?
Well, are you talking about the Easter egg hunts, Miriam, that are coming up this weekend?
You know, I think we should. Ariel, I understand you know about a lot of Easter-oriented activities coming up that are really fun for the little ones.
That's right, and at Santee Lakes, which Leon just mentioned, which happened to also have won a national award for parks. Mm. So it's an award-winning park. And they're having an extravaganza, an egg hunt, mm-hmm. on Saturday at the San Carlos Recreation Center. That's going to be an annual spring carnival and egg hunt. Mm-hmm. The Pine Hills Lodge in Julian is holding an Easter brunch and egg hunt. And hopping back to La Mesa, the Crock Hop Bunny Drop is the Crock Hop Bunny Drop will be happening. No bunnies were hurt in the production of this this festival. But anyway, that's going to be happening at the Crock Community Center on Saturday. Visitors in Spring Valley can have breakfast with the Easter Bunny there and hunt for eggs.
I believe there's a glow-in-the-dark Easter egg hunt somewhere. Where's that?
This is great. This is a unique knockoff from the original egg hunt, and it's just for older kids.
So teenagers.
They do have a limit. It's grades 6 through 9, seniors don't get too excited. But a teen glow-in-the-dark egg hunt will take place in Poway at the Lake Poway Pavilion. And I just have to tell you one more thing. It's Easter-related and kid-related. Saturday, April 19th, is the last day to ride the bunny train out at the Campo Depot.
I don't want to miss that.
Very cool.
Isn't that fun to ride through on the rails with the Easter bunny?
That is the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum in Campo, and it's actually a great place for people of all ages. You can ride not just the bunny train, but they have historic steam engine trains you can still ride, a museum full of old trains. And if you're heading out to Campo, you want to be sure you also stop. There's a motor transport museum if you like old cars, but also the Old Stone Store, which is a museum on the bottom. And then on the top level, it's the Buffalo Soldiers Museum, which was the African-American Civil War Cavalry Brigade. Its last place it was stationed was right there in Campo at Fort Lockett.
Sounds interesting.
Now, if you're interested in history, another great place is Julian. What are some of the great things people can do up in Julian there?
Well, you know, they have a little gold mine that you can actually go in and tour and pan for gold. I know on the weekend on Sundays, starting in late morning, the Julian Doves and Desperados do reenactment skits.
Very cool. Yeah, and the mine is called the Eagle Mine. And I'm not sure if they have panning for gold right there, but there is another place just outside of town. If you're coming up between Winola and Julian on the left side there, there's a place where you actually can go panning for gold. They have a petting zoo that the kids enjoy. So that's also an awful lot of fun. There's also, if you're into wildlife, there's the San Diego Wild Animal Park up in San Pasqual, sort of the northeast part of the county.
Safari Park.
I'm sorry, the San Diego Safari Park, as they call it now. They changed the name.
Yes.
There's also lions, tigers, and bears in Alpine, which is a little pricier, but it's really exciting because you can get quite up close to some of the big cats out there.
Mm-hmm.
There are some very nice wine tasting opportunities all over the backcountry. You can go visit many of the wineries throughout our mountain areas. There's some of them in the southeast part of the county. And there's even an opportunity now to go horseback riding on and wine tasting, a vineyard tour that includes wine tasting on horseback. On our website, you can check the Destination East County. You can check the East County Eater, our calendar, our festivals events section. Coming soon, Brewbeat. We're going to have all kinds of other places.
Brewbeat.
An arts and music section where we list That's things
rough.
Like the music festival.
It's a sacrifice.
Yeah, it's these are sacrifices. My staff works really hard to get this stuff for you guys.
Someone has to do it.
Yeah. That's right. Well, from all of us to all of you, we wish you a fantastic spring break.
Yeehaw!
Have fun.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
I'm John Mattis, investigative guide. Host of Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers, shining a light on shady deals all around us.
John Mattis has won 7 Emmy Awards, a Golden Mike, and the Edward R. Murrow Award for exposing fraud and corruption. Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers
is produced by the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting the Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers segment on today's East County Magazine Show. You could call this scam a license to steal. And it certainly was, until it all came crashing down on the corrupt state employees and their accomplices who were selling California driver's licenses for cash. For at least 3 years, though, between 2009 and 2012, the scammers had a nearly seamless operation that netted a tidy profit right here in East County. Here's how it worked. A man who owned a driving school let his students know that, for a price, he could guarantee them a license, even if they had already failed the driving test. Often they didn't even have to take the test, thanks to this man's connections at the Department of Motor Vehicles, that's DMV, office in El Cajon. Those willing to pay anywhere from $500 to $2,500 to corrupt DMV employees could get a license with no questions asked. The driving school catered mostly to Middle Eastern immigrants, and soon word of easy licenses in that community spread north to Los Angeles and beyond. One guy flew in from Dallas, took a cab to the DMV office, paid for his license, and flew back to Dallas a few hours later, said Special Agent Mike Peters, who investigated the case with Special Agent Kim George out of the FBI's San Diego division. It was so blatant, Agent Peters said, that our surveillance showed the driving school operator brokering multiple deals right in the DMV parking lot. Court records indicate that the group, which included Kuvan Piamari, who owned the U.S. driving school in El Cajon, Jeffrey Bednarik, a DMV examiner who conducted driving tests, and three other DMV employees took part in the long-running bribery conspiracy that produced hundreds of ill-gotten licenses. Now, in exchange for bribes, Bednarik falsely entered passing scores for written and behind-the-wheel tests for applicants seeking regular and commercial driver's licenses. He enlisted other DMV employees to falsify records as well, and he produced over 100 fraudulent driver's permits, for which applicants paid a total of more than $50,000. Sometimes the corrupt DMV employees would issue multiple bogus licenses in a single day, Agent George said. They would leave work with $500 in cash in their pocket, and that could be one day a week or two. They were doing very well. When a new manager arrived at the El Cajon DMV office, however, she instantly realized that something wasn't right. The new manager alerted the DMV's investigative arm, who in turn called the FBI. Using undercover operatives and court-authorized surveillance and wiretaps, investigators quickly uncovered the scam. Some of the candidates who paid for the licenses were bad drivers, George explained, and some paid because they were just too lazy to take the test. Agent Peters added that some had paid for commercial licenses that allowed them to drive tanker trucks. That took things to a different level in terms of public safety, he said. In all, 30 defendants have been charged with conspiracy to commit bribery and identification document fraud, and all of them have pled guilty. The case is ongoing. Bednarik is scheduled to be sentenced in April. Another DMV employee, Jim Bean, was sentenced to 18 months in prison for his role in the scheme. Agent Peters said, "We hope this case sends a message. This type of corruption will not be tolerated." The investigation into widespread corruption and bribery at the El Cajon DMV office is still active. Anyone with information is asked to contact the FBI at 1-877-NO-BRIBE.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Joy Carter, a triple board certified physician in forensic pathology and author of the book, Let Me Give You a Piece of My Mind. Don't Rent Space in My Head, Evict Negativity. And the piece is P-E-A-C-E. My guest has published two other books, Strength from Within and I Speak for the Dead. And she writes an online column titled For Goodness Sakes. She's the only African-American to own a forensic pathology consulting firm in the nation, and it is a company with the intriguing name of Biblical Dogs, Inc.
So welcome, Dr. Carter. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me. Please call me Dr. Joy.
Okay, Dr. Joy. Let's start with your latest book. It's been described as a dialogue with the reader to create a better life in today's technological world. Tell us a little bit about the purpose of that dialogue and what readers can learn from your book.
The purpose of this dialogue is to reach out to people to deal with everyday stresses, not to let it build up inside, to evict that negativity, so you can go on and pursue your goals and to be happy. I talk to the reader about situations I've been involved with, how I've dealt with them, how to kind of laugh it off, deal with it, and then move on to your next goal.
So these are ways that have worked for you.
Yes.
To keep you afloat, to inspire you.
Yes.
Okay. You were in practice for 30 years?
31 years.
31 years. In addition to teaching forensic pathology, it's a fascinating field. It doesn't seem related to the types of stories that you're writing. Can you explain what drew you to the field in the first place and how it led you to write a book on family and relationships?
Well, I got involved with forensic pathology when I was still in high school. I was just intrigued by the fact of being able to investigate death, examine the body, help a family through the end of life, determine what caused the death, put information into the medical record, then also to give testimony and really try to right some wrongs. I've been dealing with death since 14, mm-hmm. and my way of counteracting that is to write. Life is short. I think you try to enjoy it, reduce your stress, and I reach out by writing. One of the things I do to help relax and share my information.
And so the negativity that comes from work for you as a pathologist, you've utilized these tools
yes.
to keep it from taking the piece in your own head. Is that correct?
Correct. That's so right. I mean, I see the worst society has to offer every day. When you
right.
see the body of an abused child, an innocent elderly person, a young person that's gone astray and dying of drugs, alcoholism, self-violence.
Uh-huh.
You have to find a way to deal with that or it will eat at you. I'm very firm in my convictions on death and life and the fact that there's an energy that flows out of the body. My work has allowed me to really investigate and learn from other people's religious beliefs. No matter what they are, you can take some comfort in that. And by reaching out to people and they say, well, how do you cope with it? I write, I carry on, I bring out my inner strength to do the examination, and it helps me to help a family through it, to talk them through it, to counsel them after the death has occurred.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have the distinction of being the first African-American chief medical examiner in the history of the country. What was that like for you, and how have your experiences led you to mentor minority women in particular?
Well, when I got started in forensics in high school, back in those days before the internet, I wrote to a doctor who had written some articles that I could understand at age 14. That was Dr. Joe Davis, the chief medical examiner of Miami, Florida. I wrote to him, and he actually wrote me back. I asked him, what can I do? I'm interested in forensics. I'm only in high school. And he took me seriously. And we carried on a dialogue for years until we met face-to-face when I was in medical school.
Oh,
he told me what to focus on. He told me how he dealt with death. We shared a love of gospel music. And that mentoring kept me focused on my career and propelled me forward. I've literally been a chief medical examiner for 28 of my 31 years in medical practice. And you have to give back. And so I mentor young people. It doesn't matter what their ethnicity is. It doesn't matter how young they are, because I had my dream at 14.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents nurtured that. And I try to nurture other young people. I may do it sight unseen through the internet, through email, when I go out and talk. Sometimes I say to children, have you ever hugged a doctor? Well, then come give me a hug.
Oh.
I'm a real person.
Right.
I want to encourage them to strive for whatever it is that they need to do.
Mm-hmm.
I try to do that by encouraging with education and really having that self-determination and love for yourself to put yourself through all that training.
Would you say that your new book is targeted to anyone in particular or just the public in general?
The public in general, but there are three chapters that I love because I wrote them to my grandson.
Oh.
I want him to be a good steward. I want him to be a good citizen. And I can still hear my grandmother telling me things that kept me on the straight and narrow, things that were actually written out in books about be kind, be respectful, things you learn in management, but I already learned them. So I can still hear her voice. He will be able to hear mine and read mine in the future.
Very good. Let's talk about your consulting business, Biblical Dogs, Inc. How is forensic consulting different than the other work you've done? And what's the story behind the name Biblical Dogs?
I am a dog lover from birth. My mother said at age 2, I'd go up to any dog with no fear. I love dogs. At the time that I formed my company, I had 2 English Mastiffs. I called them my 2 tons of fun, and they were named Samson and Delilah. And that's where the name came from. And on my very first book, Samson was on there with me. That's how that name came about. And the forensic consulting happened because forensic pathology is a non-hospital-based medical specialty. It's usually conducted in a coroner's office or a medical examiner, and you're charged with death investigation for a particular entity, whether it's a city, county, state, or the federal government. The consulting aspect comes from being asked to look at other people's work to find answers. So I develop a reputation for being honest and being strong and backing up my opinion. And so I'm asked to consult very frequently. Generally, as a medical examiner, you're employed by a government and you become a state's witness. And it occurred to me that a lot of times people who are poor, minority, or just don't have the background, don't have the opportunity to have somebody of my stature speak for them.
Right.
And so I stay very busy consulting for indigent firms, for people who need a second look, for people who don't want to be run over by the system. I become their advocate. I look at things and I tell them the truth. I tell them the facts. And I have always enjoyed doing that, and I stay very busy doing that.
Great. One last question. What's next for you as an author? Are you working on another book? And if so, can you give us a hint what that will bring us?
I am working on a couple of books. I continue to do my column, so there will be a part 2 for Let Me Give You a Piece of My Mind.
Okay.
I'm working on a book because I'm from a very, very small town in Ohio, and it's actually called A Colored Girl from a Small Town Leading a Colorful Life.
Ooh,
about
I like that.
My travels around the world and who I have encountered.
Mm-hmm. It sounds really fascinating.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Joy, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
If you would like more information on Dr. Joy Carter and her books, please visit her website at www.joymcartermd.com, and her name is spelled J-O-Y-E. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.